You are listening to The Grandest Tour by The Cycling Podcast. Brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Today, we are at the Giro d'Italia.
Cozze, cittere, cozze, cozze, vicine. Non spigudeci ancora, non spigudeci ancora. Cozze, cittere, cozze, cozze, vicine. Non spigudeci ancora, se non mangiano le femmine.
Hello, my name is Riccardo Murisotto. I might not be in Italy anymore. I'm back in France, but I'm holding on to my Italian moniker. And I'm joined tonight by Lionelli Bernierini.
Whoa, honoured. I'm honoured. Although I've not set foot in Italy this year, I'm nevertheless honoured. Don't ask me to pronounce my own surname there. I'll just butcher it.
Yeah, no. Well, you'll get used to it over the however long the Giro lasts. You'll get used to it. We were going to be joined by Daniele Fribrancini tonight, but unfortunately he is unavailable at the last minute. It's complicated, isn't it? We're all kind of home now and got other things going on. And I think Daniel will be joining us again before he heads off to the Vuelta, and then we'll be hearing from him at the Vuelta as well. But from tomorrow, we've got a rotating cast of guest presenters, don't we, Lionel?
We have indeed. Kicking off with Ian Boswell, who's ridden and completed the Giro d'Italia. We'll also be hearing from Francois Tomaseau for a few days, and Lizzie Banks, double Giro Rosa stage winner, of course. So, we'll have their thoughts on the Giro, the Vuelta, the Tour of Flanders, and everything else that goes ahead between now and November the 8th or whenever it happens to be. It's very uncertain, yeah. Isn't it? It feels very uncertain.
And you're back in the saddle yourself, Lionel, after a bit of time resting. Do you feel charged up? Probably an unfortunate phrase in a cycling context. Do you feel ready to go?
I've been in the saddle quite a lot, Richard. I've been doing indoor cycling,
the Zwift rides,
every day since the start of the Giro. I'm intending to ride every day until the end of the Vuelta. So I'm doing my own indoor Grandest Tour. And there are organised rides, meet-up rides on Zwift. The next one is tomorrow night, actually. So if anyone out there is listening, check out our Twitter or Facebook pages and you'll find a link where you can pretty easily enter any of the rides that you want to do. I'm going to do them on Sunday mornings between now and November the 8th. But there's also one tomorrow evening. Are you going to join that one, Richard, maybe?
I might do, yeah. Let me check things. But I'm planning to go out on my bike tomorrow morning, actually. Weather's not bad here. And I've been really looking forward to getting back out on my bike. So, I could do a double session tomorrow. It's been a week or so off the bike completely. So
hardcore.
I'll probably do me some good. Work off some of that pasta.
Well, I was going to ask the key question from your stint in Italy. What was the best meal? You only sent a couple of meal photos to me. I wondered whether you were being sensitive. You didn't want to make me fear that I was missing out
hardly,
too much.
Hardly, Lionel. I think if there had been photos to send, they would have been sent. It's hard to pick our favourite. We had a very nice meal in Matera. I mean, everything about Matera was fantastic. But in a lot of ways, it might not have been the sort of fanciest food, but the most memorable occasion was a couple of nights ago in our trabocchi that we mentioned last night. Our trabocco, sorry. Trabocchi is the plural. For these kind of fishermen's shacks that sit out in the water along the coastline where we were. And I'd pass it during the day and wondered what it was, to be honest, not realising it was, by night, a restaurant that was sort of fully illuminated and a kind of cosy little outpost on a really wild night. And I can imagine in summer, it's a very different experience. It felt very autumnal / early winter, and the wind was blowing, a storm was raging outside almost, and you could feel I just wondered if we were going to, have a wave crash over us at some point. That's what it felt and sounded like. So we're sitting there in our jackets and thick jumpers, tucking into lots of seafood, and it was a sort of place where you don't have a menu and you were just brought different dishes, and it was all seafood and all very, very delicious, lovely. So that was probably the best meal I think I had. I don't think Daniel would agree because he's not a big seafood fan, but it's
extraordinary.
I really enjoyed
extraordinary.
That.
Is there anything he does eat? Doesn't eat eggs or mushrooms, I think, as well?
Doesn't
eat, seafood?
Not only does he not eat eggs, he doesn't trust people who eat eggs.
Anyway.
We should probably get to the cycling, eh? There were double header today, two sprint stages with Skel de Priest in Belgium, and the stage 11 in the Giro was very much a sprinter's stage today. Quite interesting to sort of exercise to maybe compare the two sprint finishes and wonder who might have won between the two winners. But do you have a tale of the tapper, please, Lionel?
I guess I do. I'm a bit out of practice, Rich. You've been coping manfully in my absence.
Well, James Knox did it last night.
Indeed,
and did a brilliant job.
Great job that was. Yeah, well, you mentioned seafood and being by the sea. The race today finished in Rimini. And I was quite surprised that the Giro has not had a finish in Rimini since 1960. You would think a big kind of tourist destination like that would have had the Giro in the last half century and more, but it hasn't. But it was a stage win number four for French champion Arnaud Démare, ahead of Peter Sagan and Alvaro Hodge. Great result for Scotland, that, wasn't it, Richard? I'm sure you were out of your seat. Before
waving my Scottish flag.
Before all of that, there was a breakaway which included Mattea Baez of Androni Giocattoli, Fabio Mazzucco of Bardiani, along with his teammate Francesco Romano, Sander Armé of Lotto Soudal, and Marco Frapporti of Vini Zabu. That group split up, and then on the run-in, Armé was left out in front on his own, and that just reminded me of the Vuelta from 2017, because Sander Armé won, if you remember, Richard, on the day that it turned out that Chris Froome had returned elevated salbutamol levels in his anti-doping sample, which kicked off a saga that ran deep into the following year and in overlap with the start of that year's Giro, of course, which he went on to win. It was also the night in Spain where a bat was in my bedroom at our B&B, and we had a very unnerving meal where the B&B owner played the song Hallelujah, various different versions of the song Hallelujah by Leonard Cohen on a loop while he watched us eat. I just always will associate Sander Armé with that incident. Anyway, was
one of the versions not also starring himself?
It was, that's right, good memory. Yes, it was extremely strange. And I thought that we might not make it through the night. Fortunately, when I went to bed, the bat had vacated my room. As somebody pointed out on Twitter today when I mentioned this, perhaps it was the bat's room after all, and I was the interloper. I don't know, but it was a very unusual evening. I remember Simon, the photographer, as we drove into the depth of the Spanish countryside, he just dropped in the bombshell that tonight's hotel could be a bit of a wild card, and he wasn't wrong. It knocked all Daniel's hillside haciendas into a cocked hat. But anyway, Sander Armé didn't make it to the finish. It set up quite a sprint finish. Now, Elia Viviani had earlier come to grief because he was hit by a motorcycle going around a roundabout about 30-ish kilometres from the finish and had to chase on. Did get back in, but didn't really feature in the sprint. His teammate Consoni was up there, but no one could match Démare. A very impressive fourth stage win for him. And as our friend Francois Tomazo pointed out, the first Frenchman since Bernardino, in fact, I think only the second Frenchman ever, to win four stages in an edition of the Giro d'Italia. And when Eno did it, two of the stages he won were time trials. So very impressive by Démare. Clearly the sprinter in this Giro.
You are listening to The Grandest Tour by The Cycling Podcast. Brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWocker. If you run a business, find out more at iWocker.co.uk. iWOCA iwalka.co.uk.
Thank you very much indeed to iWalka, our title sponsor. And if you run a small business or know somebody who does, go to iwalka.co.uk, I-W-O-C-A, to see what iWalka can offer you. There's lots of information there, as well as details about funding that they can offer, finance that they can offer if you run a small business, including the Coronavirus Business Interruption Loan Scheme. They are accredited by the Business Bank, British Business Bank, to award those. Now, Lionel, there was another race, another sprinters race, as I mentioned earlier, Scheldeprijs, entirely in Belgium. It usually starts in the Netherlands, but with the current situation, that wasn't an option this year, and it happened entirely on the circuit in close to Antwerp. It's always a sprinter's race. It's frequently a dangerous race. There have been bad crashes there over the years, and there was another one today. Caleb Ewan was a pretty convincing winner, and behind him, Pascal Ackermann, the German sprinter on Bora Hansgrohe, switched pretty alarmingly and illegally, as it turned out, and caused a really bad crash behind him. August Jensen of Rewal Securitas went down really hard. Ivan Garcia Cortina also came down pretty heavily. So a lot of people picked up on the fact that Ackermann's teammate, Rudy Zellig, stopped immediately when he saw the crash, went back and helped Jensen, which was nice to see. But it was horrific, and we understand Jensen's okay, nothing serious, amazingly, wrong with him. But yeah, Ackermann was relegated or disqualified. Caleb Ewan was the winner, Nicola Bonifazio second, and Brian Cockar third. Pretty much a standard edition of Scheldeprijs, that. And Mark Cavendish rode, and once again he was in the breakaway, clearly not going for the sprint, finished 143rd in the end. And a lot of people commented on the fact that he was seen very deliberately folding up his numbers at the end and putting them in his pocket, as if he was planning to keep them as a memento if this does indeed turn out to be his last race. We don't know that yet. But it does raise an intriguing question. And I guess there was a discussion on our Facebook discussion group as well about about Demar, started by Francois Thomazeau, who
trolling
our
listeners. Yeah.
Yeah, he remembers some less than complimentary comments made about Demar. He's maybe over the years not been considered to be in that kind of very top rank of sprinters, but he is now. He's been really prolific this year. He said that he's focused less on trying to be a kind of classics rider, an all-rounder, and more on just being a pure sprinter. He's at the Giro with a team that's really, built to support him and support him very well. We've commented a lot on the sheer sort of physical size of them. He lost his second lead-out man, Ramon Sinkeldam, yesterday, didn't finish the stage, he's been unwell. But our diarist, Jacopo Guarnieri, has been a fantastic lead-out man. Miles Scottson has been great as well. He always comes through the kilometre to go, kite in front. And Groupama FTJ really got it absolutely bang on again today. Lots of other teams were up there trying to set up their sprinters, and Groupama were there, then they kind of slipped back a bit, and then they came back to the front with a real vengeance, about a kilometre and a half to go, with perfect timing. And again, it was pretty straightforward for Demar.
Yeah, it was. I mean, you mentioned that controversy after the Milan San Remo that he won a few years ago. That was in 2016.
San Remo.
It was in San Remo, that's right, it was. Well done, Richard. You've clearly been revising the old cycling while you've been at the Giro. That was in 2016. And, the allegation was made by a couple of riders, Matteo Tosato and Eros Capecchi, that after a crash, Demar had held onto a team car, to get back on as they went over the Cipressa. Now, the reason this blew up was because there was a Strava file, and then the Strava file was taken down off Demar's Strava account. And, you know, he denied that anything untoward had happened, but it did take a little bit of the gloss off that victory, I felt. But this season, since restart, he's been prolific. I mean, remember how impressively he won Milano Torino right at the start of the resumption back at the beginning of August, which feels like quite a long time ago now. But he's been winning all over the shop in the Tour de Wallonie and Poitou-Charentes and the French National Road Race Championships, of course. And, well, you covered this talking about his earlier stage wins, Rich, about I think Daniel made the point that, you know, Demar was not really expecting to ride the Tour de France because everything was all in for Thibaut Pinot. But here we are at the Giro, and, you know, four stage wins, it is impressive. And the idea that this is somehow not a terribly deep sprinting field, I don't really think that holds up, because you know, we've got Peter Sagan there, we've got Viviani and Gaviria, both of whom look a bit out of sorts. But I wouldn't say, if you put the names down on paper, I wouldn't say that the sprinting field here is all that much shallower than it was at the Tour de France. And no one was saying that those wins were in any way diminished. So, no, fair play to Demar.
I struggle to imagine any sprinter beating him at the moment, you know, regardless of who's here and who isn't. And I think, you know, the form he's in, the team he has, it looks really formidable. And, yeah, more convincing than any sprinter at the Tour. It's kind of an impossible puzzle to try and figure out.
Well, okay, let me put the question to you. Who was the fastest? Who was the most impressive? Who would have won if you put them side by side today, Demar or Ewan? It'd be interesting to know the data, wouldn't it? And whether you can extract from sort of power outputs and what have you, who the winner would have been. I guess you can.
Difficult. Will we hear from somebody who does know certainly how well Demar is going? That's his lead out man, Jacopo Guarnieri. We'll hear in a little bit as well from Elia Viviani with quite a fascinating insight into his own form and, you know, why he's perhaps not quite as sharp as we've seen him in the past. But yeah, Jacopo Guarnieri is keeping an audio diary for us, one of six riders. I have to mention that today's Kilometre Zero, powered by Zwift, features three of our diarists, including Rick Zabel. And if you haven't listened to that, do give it a listen, because really fascinating comments from him about the Giro and the threat of COVID, both from a health point of view individually, but also from a sort of public health and perception point of view. Really, it's really interesting stuff from Rick Zabel. But Jacopo Guarnieri touches on that as well, and on the uncertainty that is currently sort of clouding the Giro. Here he is, Jacopo Guarnieri.
So here we are again on the car heading to the hotel after a lot of interview, but it was a real pleasure because we got the first victory of this Giro with Arnaud. It was really great today. Really happy because yesterday we lost our penultimate guy in the lead out, Sinkeldam. And so we were just six today, and we had to chase back a good breakaway. And well, it was pretty hectic. The finale was not easy to organize ourselves with so much twists and turns and roundabouts and narrows. So, well, I think at the end, everything worked out pretty good. It was one of the best leads that we ever did this year. So we're really, really happy. And well, felt great. I mean, we had 11 stages so far and four victories. So it's like just crazy. I mean, I can used to it. We can be addicted to victory. Huh? It's a nice feeling. But yeah, we were really looking forward for this victory. Today we put everything possible to arrive all together at the sprint. And well, just perfect. And nothing else to say. Just perfect. And yeah, the last 2 days was pretty fast, also yesterday. And well, yeah, everybody's talking about this raising number of COVID as well in the Giro, but even normal people, I would say. And yeah, the situation is start to be a little bit more worrying, especially in Italy, because yesterday I was checking the news and it was 6,000 positives. And yeah, I mean, in the Giro, I would say we are more or less okay. Of course, like what we see with the Yates, for example, he just positive, and everybody tested negative at the same time, and after 3 days they were more positive. So yeah, to be honest, it's very likely that the one positive in the staff and or a rider in other teams very likely could become more in the next few days, but yeah, hope not. But you never know. Personally, I think like the Giro could go on, but I'm really scared what like Italian government could say, because it's a news from yesterday in Italy. It's like the I don't know in English, the meeting. Yeah, the meeting of six people, more than six people, is forbidden. So yeah, we are under 40. So I don't know. I'm really, really scared that one of these days, you know, just to show something to the Italian people, which are not really happy to be close or of the idea of another lockdown, that they will say, okay, we close everything and the Giro must stop. But we cannot know at the moment. We just can be focused. Our part as a team, a group of my FDJ, we could be, yeah, we don't have a GC, so we are not thinking like, oh my God, if they stop the Giro tomorrow. The only thing we can do, and I think every team is doing, is just like trying to racing as we will arrive to Milan. We cannot control this thing, because we can just put our everything in place to be safe. So washing hands, keep distancing, and mask when we can. But of course, it's something that goes beyond the single person, and especially can go beyond the Giro. So yeah, we will see how it goes in the next days. There will be more tests for everyone in even before the rest day, as yeah, it's natural to say that it's a good choice. I won't be happy to have another Cotton Fuel Cup on my brain, but yeah, this is the way it is. So well, for the moment I will, and we will try to celebrate, to enjoy the moment. Tonight we will celebrate another beer. So yeah, goddamn, Arnaud. I mean, if you go on like this, I can be addicted to alcohol, because every day we have to celebrate something. So nah, kidding. Really happy. So I'll try to save you the moment. And tomorrow, yeah, it's gonna be really, really hard. I hope everybody will be connected to the TV, because the parcours is gonna be really, really challenging. It's gonna be up and down all day, and it's gonna be rain like hell. So yeah, all the winter clothing are ready to get out of the winter bag, and yeah, hopefully we will all survive.
Well, that was Jacopo Guarnieri, who's one of the six riders keeping an audio diary for us at this Giro d'Italia. Really interesting from him again, insight into, you know, being part of that Arnaud Démare lead out train and the situation in Italy. And it's quite striking hearing quite a few riders talk, you know, as if they're on borrowed time with the Giro, as if, you know, within the peloton there's real genuine uncertainty about whether it can make it all the way to Milan. Another sprinter at the Giro who's been very successful here in the past is, of course, Elia Viviani, now at Cofidis, and not the force he was last year when he was at De Koenig and Quickstep. Why is that? We don't really know. He doesn't really know. As Daniel said in the podcast a night or so ago, I think, he's been, according to his team, very kind of diligent and professional in his preparation, as he always is. He's also always very honest in interviews, and Daniel spoke to him at the start yesterday just to try and understand why he's perhaps not got the sharp edge that he had in the last couple of years.
I've been speaking to people in your team the last few days, and they say that, well, as was to be expected, I suppose, your resistance has gone up after the tour, but your explosiveness, maybe, as happens with most riders, has gone down. Can you just explain the sensations you've been feeling when you've been sprinting, when you've been trying to sprint?
As you can see, I think we can't say I'm not there. I'm there, but I miss something. That is the reality. So this explosion, probably, I miss. I tried to walk in these 14 days in the middle from Giro and Tour, and probably it isn't a good idea to have the peak power, but it wasn't a good idea, because in that period I also need recovery. So it's a balance. When you're following something, it's always a balance you need to broken, and that balance is not the top shape. So I climb well, I going well, I survive well the hard stage like the last Sunday. And
you were in a group very close to the front 2 days ago.
Yeah, that is showing like my shape is there. I just miss deck explosion in the final. As you can see, also if I'm in good position, 4th, 5th, I can really kick off and then go for the win. So for that, we don't really just hang. We just continuing to try and believe, because probably also now we have already 9 days in the legs. Also the other sprinter is going to lose a little bit that. So the point is now the Mar is on fire. His team is super strong in the lead out. We need to be focused to go in good position. Probably the best position is his wheel, and found this just good pedal, good kickoff power in the final. So that is the way I can try to win. If not, I just need to show I'm still there, and then we're working for sure as a team to improve all together, because that is the other point of this year. It was a strange year. We never put the pieces together. Like I say, we follow something we never reach, and it's a thing we need to fix, absolutely.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport, our longtime sponsor. And I can't put Daniel on the spot tonight to recite the Science in Sport discount code, which is unfortunate. He finally nailed it last night in Italian, of course. but if you would like 25% off all your Science in Sport products, your gels, your bars, your drinks, go to scienceofsport.com and at the checkout enter the discount code SISCP25. I know that you know it, Lionel, so I won't test you. But before the break there, we heard from Elia Viviani with a very honest kind of assessment of where he's at.
Yeah, curious one, this, because Viviani's come out of the Tour de France as well, and you know he was off the pace a little bit there. His best result was 4th at Ile de Ré the day that Sam Bennett won. He also had a 6th in Nice right at the start and a 5th on the Champs-Élysées. But you know, 5th and 6th are kind of the sort of second division, the top of the second division, really, isn't it? And he's, well, you can't blame him for today, of course, because he came to grief when a motorbike was, well, to put it mildly, was in a position where it really shouldn't have been, trying to make a manoeuvre that it shouldn't have been trying to make. I mean, you know, there's not really much more to say about that other than it shouldn't have been trying to move up in the bunch round a kind of double roundabout. But sort of emblematic of Viviani's luck. You know, when your luck is out, your luck's really out, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And I thought it was really interesting what he was talking about in terms of that balance between speed and fitness, and that, you know, when he's as fit as he is now, his endurance is up, but his speed is slightly down. And I mean, all riders are different. We had Ben Swift on a couple of days ago, or yesterday, I think, saying that when he's really fit, he also thinks he's faster. And that's kind of borne out by his results. I suppose every rider is different, but Viviani, you know, coming here from the Tour, it has blunted his edge a little bit, but as you say, he wasn't very competitive at the Tour either. And inevitably, people will wonder about the move from De Koenig Quickstep to Cofidis. I mean, it just, you know, I said this on the podcast a while ago, that no rider's ever improved having left De Koenig Quickstep. And of course, I was sent various names of riders who have improved. But sprinters in particular, you know, they've tended to have a marquee sprinter who has tended not to be quite as effective when he's moved on the last few years. That's just, I think, a fact. Mark Cavendish did go on and win 4 stages at the Tour for Dimension Data, but in general, you know, he didn't seem the same force. Marcel Kittel as well, and now Viviani.
Yeah.
I would even throw Gaviria in there too, I think.
Wow.
Sorry, not as consistent.
I was just going to say, I mean, Gaviria is a good point. I mean, today he looked like he was going to get going, and then he just sat down again and realised he didn't have it. And it's a point that we kind of made in the Kilometre Zero episode at the Tour de France, when Sam Bennett didn't get off the mark for De Koenig Quickstep in the first week of the tour, and you could just sense that pressure starting to tighten up, because De Koenig Quickstep expect victories. They are prolific, and we made the sort of slightly clumsy comparison with being a striker for one of the top football clubs. Lots of chances get made for you and you're expected to finish them off. At Cofidis, they don't really have the same sort of tradition of just creating an opportunity every day. They don't get it right every day, whereas, you know, De Koenig Quickstep, even when things aren't singing, they're all kind of in position. They all know exactly what they're doing. There's not a sort of period of several months where they're all getting to know one another again. And so it's not really working for Viviani, but there are still some more chances as long as he hasn't suffered too badly from the incident with a motorbike today.
Indeed. Lionel, Daniel and I came back from the Giro with a couple of interviews, which we thought we'd play. Alex Dowsett, stage winner on stage 8, of course, a very popular winner, not least because it highlighted the fact that he's out of contract the end of the year and looking for a new team, and a lot of people were surprised to learn that. So caught up with him at the start yesterday morning, and Daniel caught up with Attila Valter, the young Hungarian on CCC, who featured in our Giro. We did an episode on what would have been the Hungarian start, and Valter was one of the young riders that we interviewed there, and we heard from him, and he's actually joining Groupama FDJ next year. A very, very talented rider. But let's hear first from Alex Dowsett, whose stage win on stage 8 was emotional and one that a lot of people enjoyed. Sunk in what you did the other day. I mean, you must have enjoyed the rest day after that.
Yeah, I had a horror of a day, like stage 9. But yeah, rest day is always nice. You're going into a rest day with a stage win under your belt. So the team was in good spirits. It was nice. We were sharing the hotel with EF as well, and it was nice to see them so happy, because obviously they've had a very good start, and I know Ruben from Katusha is just like really happy for him as well.
Was that a sort of hangover, not a literal hangover, but was it quite difficult? Obviously the weather was terrible, but was it quite difficult Sunday?
Yeah, very difficult. I really struggled. I think I just didn't drink enough afterwards. After the race, I usually get about sort of 2 or 3 litres down my neck between the end of one stage and the start of the next. Very much not used to the whole podium protocol afterwards, and in the past I've not eaten enough and then struggled the next day, and here I just didn't drink enough and struggled the next day, but Matthias Brandt got me through it, which was nice. We're good. The time cuts here on the hard days are really quite big, so we were more comfortable than we thought we were.
There was an incredible reaction to your win. That must have been quite a thing to scroll through all your messages.
It was pretty, it was very overwhelming. It's very nice. It's extremely nice. It's not just like all the messages on social media, but actually the next day, all the riders saying well done. It was riders I almost never talked to. You realise how... I've been in this peloton a long time now, and there's a lot of, I sort of know everyone, and it's just nice knowing that.
I guess it prompts people to say something that, you know, who you might not have even known that well, or known that they'd followed you that well.
Yeah. I mean, I think Warren Barguil sent me a message. We've never spoken, but we sort of follow each other, and he just sent me a message. He was like, I'm really happy for you. Like, I just really enjoyed, quite funny on Twitter and stuff. And that sort of stuff.
I was going to ask you after the stage. I mean, you obviously won a stage 7 years ago. Was there anything there that you, any lessons from that that you're able to deploy this time? Even, you know, enjoying the moment, maybe, because, you know, sometimes riders say they don't enjoy the moment, but if they get another chance, they do. Was that the case?
Yeah, very, very much so. I think 2013 was my first ever Grand Tour, stage 8, so it was still early on in the race, and I was still fairly new to cycling, and probably I was an arrogant little prick as well. But not too bad, but I was obviously a prick. I was like, okay, I've come to a Grand Tour, I've won a stage, I'm probably going to win a lot more. And there was that aspect, and there was also, I didn't grow up a cycling fan. I was a motor racing fan because of my dad, so I never fully understood just how big it is to win a Grand Tour stage, and that sort of sunk in over, you know, even here prior to stage eight, they still talk about the fact that I'm a stage winner from 2013. It is just how big it is. So you definitely, yeah, like when I was coming to the line, I was in kind of disbelief that it all gone.
Avoid the dog and get to the line.
Yeah. I channeled my inner Steve Cummings and jumped away at exactly the right time, you know. It's definitely enjoy it a lot more.
And it was a great way of advertising the fact that you're looking for a team. I mean, any news on that front, any developments? Rest days are always busy, but
I mean, it's still, it's kind of been a weekend and it's still very, very new. The overarching cloud of what's going to happen with this race with COVID and everything, and the weather in the third week, but yeah, it wouldn't have done me any harm.
And on the COVID, I mean, your team's clear, but obviously a couple of teams affected. That must be a bit of a concern.
Yeah, I feel for Mitchelton. They've not had a lot of luck. Yeah, especially when it's completely out of their hands what's happened. It's a worry. It definitely is a worry. There's questions being asked within our team bus as to how responsible it is to be racing, but you trust that the UCI are being responsible, the RCS and the CPA, they have our backs on this. None of us are doctors, so we don't truly know, but we just hope that the right decisions are being made. At the end of the day, it's like whether we go home, it's like if we go home, what are we going home to? Like, I'll go home and see my dad who's just about to hit 70, and he would be categorised at risk, and it's tough. I feel sorry for the people having to make these decisions.
Well, Richard, that was one of the highlights. I mean, I've been an armchair viewer for the first half of the Giro, but that stage was one of the highlights, just because seeing the break pull it off, and Alex Dowsett and his teammate Mateus Brandlett, you know, play the old 1-2 tactics so well. It was impressive, and you know, as a keen student of the old time trialing back in the day, you know, Alex Dowsett took off with roughly 10 miles to go, didn't he? It was a sort of a 10 mile time trial at the end of a 180 kilometer stage, and it was very impressive. And then of course to see the dog in the finish straight, very impressed to hear you got an interview with the dog, but disappointed that you didn't get it translated into English.
I was hoping inevitably there were a few inquiries on social media as to whether that was in fact Rosie the dog, and this will be lost on many listeners, but there's a very popular podcast presented by comedian Adam Buxton, and his dog Rosie features in that podcast. And you pointed out a year or so ago, Lionel, that the voice of Rosie the dog is not dissimilar to the voice of Alex Dowsett.
I'm afraid this was for friends of the podcast only, Richard. It was only ever intended to be for our very, very good friends of the podcast to hear. But I can reveal that the dog's interview, when translated, it goes something like this. Alex is my favourite rider, and I saw a gap in the barriers, and I just went for it to say congratulations.
Oh, well, there we go. Better late than never. Fantastic. There we are.
Oh, sorry,
I
everyone.
Hope Alex Dowsett only listened to his interview and then turned off if he is listening. Sorry, Alex. I mentioned that Daniel also spoke to a very promising young Hungarian rider. He's 22 years old, and he is actually 22nd on GC as well. There haven't been many Hungarians over the years, so be interested to see how he and one or two others get on. He signed a two-year contract with Groupama FTJ from next year.
I think there've been loads of Hungarians over the years. There just haven't been many top-level Hungarian cyclists over the years.
Did I not finish that sentence properly? Oh dear, I'm getting ahead of myself. Yeah, there are loads of Hungarians, but not many of them are professional cyclists or haven't been. Anyway, thanks for that. Here's Attila Valter.
Your first Grand Tour seems to be going pretty well. Just sum it up from your point of view so far.
Yeah, I think also it's going pretty well. I didn't know what to expect from myself, so already at the first time when it started to be hard on the Etna, I dropped. And now when the situation is getting hard after the race day with all the positives. I a little bit regretted to let so much time on the Etna because I feel better and better every day. Now the fight for the GC is really interesting, I think. We don't know when the race will stop, so I'm also afraid we cannot reach Milan. So it will be a war from today, I think.
What were your sensations like the other day on the Stage de Roccaraza when you're in that group very close to the top guys on GC? How were you feeling?
All day I had pretty good legs. I think the best of the Giro. The first went pretty easy for me. I was not trying to get into the break because it was really hard. The first 80k, nothing went straight. After, it was really hard in the cold. I'm not really big fan of the cold weather. I was too afraid to go back to the car to take more clothes because every moment something could happen. So I was there with full wet clothes. It was really hard, but the legs was still pretty good in the final climb, so I tried to help Ilnur as much as possible, but in the final steep part I just gave it a go and tried to pass a few riders. I think it can be even better in the future.
What's the longest race you've ever done, Attila? Have you gone beyond 10 or 12 days ever?
I've done Tour de l'Avenir, it was 10 days last year.
So it's a bit of a step into the unknown this week. What do you think is going to happen to your body this week? What do you expect to happen?
I don't think the biggest question is what my body will respond or how the race will go. Like, nobody knows how many stages we have left. So I think it will be a really open race, and it will be like there is no other day. Every race, every day we should race like that. There is no more stages. So I hope for the same legs like last week. I think it will be like that. I really wanted to reach the third week to see how I perform in the big climbs. I hope we can do that. But yeah, let's see. Before that, I also want to try something.
And if the temperature is zero, as it was yesterday in Bormio and on the Stelvio, you guys can't descend 25 kilometers in those temperatures, can you?
I also think it's not a proper bike racing anymore. If you have to descend in the snow and 0 degrees, it's kind of like a surviving race. It's not like a bike race. So all the teams have pretty good clothes. We can do that, but it's... It will be different from the regular racing. So I hope it will be, if we reach Stelvio and will be really bad weather there, we can cancel it and do some smaller climbs.
So Attila Valtra there at CCC, and you know, that's a team coming to an end, and he luckily has got another berth. He, like Jacopo Guarnieri earlier on, seems, you know, pessimistic about the Giro. It's funny being on the race and being in the bubble, if I can use that word, because the bubble at the Giro is certainly not comparable to the bubble that was at the Tour. I think when you're there, you know, you're part of this show that rolls on every day with a sort of inevitability. You don't really sort of see the threat to, or I didn't feel that. And I guess another bit of news today that we didn't mention already, but it's quite significant. Michael Matthews, who went home from the race, a Sunweb rider, after a positive COVID test, had another test that came back negative. And we spoke a bit last night, I think it was last night, about the different tests that the Giro are using and which are popular in Italy, but might not be as accurate as the PCR tests. And you know, I think about that, and I think, well, it's very unfortunate for Michael Matthews if indeed it was a false positive the first one. We don't know that for sure, but that's a suggestion. But imagine if his team had pulled out. You know, Wilco Kelderman looks like possibly the strongest rider in the race, and there has been a bit of pressure on them. You know, having sent a rider home, so it's a difficult, messy situation.
It is, and again, from my vantage point at home watching the race, you know, it has at various times felt like, oh, everything's going okay, and then suddenly it feels like it's teetering on the brink, and particularly listening to Rick Zabel's comments, which are in that Kilometre Zero episode you mentioned earlier, Richard. You know that in a group of 140-odd riders that are left in the race, there will be some who are more risk-averse than others, some who feel less comfortable than others. I think it's, you know, I've seen a lot of comments on social media sort of saying that there should be some kind of hard and fast protocol criteria, criticisms of the UCI for not having, you know, not being right on top of this. But I think that really it is a very much a case of taking it step by step, day by day, and for the people on the ground and for the governments, both national and local, to make their call. I mean, you know, you couldn't have a complaint if, for example, the race went into a region where the local politician said, look, sorry, cases are getting out of control here, so therefore we don't want today's stage to take place, as happened at the Binkbank Tour, for example. That would just have to be something that the Giro or the Vuelta, when we come to it, would have to take. But I really don't think that by continuing the races are doing anything untoward, because if they have permission from the authorities, then they have permission from the authorities, and that's kind of it, really, isn't it? We have to just hope that things can carry on as safely as they possibly can. But it does feel quite different all round to the initial lockdown. I think there is more of a sense that a balance has to be struck, and that some aspects of everyday life and business does have to try to keep going.
Yeah, I kind of, you know, go one way and then the other with it. It's, you know, I find Rick Zabel's concerns quite affecting, really. You know, and Richard Pluger as well gave an interview to Orla Shinnewy for Eurosport today. He had COVID himself and says that he's still feeling the effects. And, you know, he talked about this, you know, long COVID and effects of having it that might not be immediately apparent. There's a lot we don't know. And, you know, there's the rider's health to think about, and that, he said, was a big factor in their decision, Jumbo Visma's decision to withdraw from the race. But at the same time, I agree with you too that it is about balance. And, you know, we heard from Alex Dowsett earlier, who said that he doesn't envy those who have to make decisions. They're not easy decisions at all, and that's politicians, but also in this case a race organizer.
I think what I was trying to express really was that I don't think it's terribly helpful for us to make baddies of the people who are trying to keep things going. And, you know, I certainly wouldn't criticise if, say, the Giro had to take a day off and say, look, we're not going through this region or any race. I think, because this is going to be with us into next year. So, you know, whilst I understand that, you know, the call for kind of a hard and fast protocol, I'm not terribly sure that would be practical anyway, because once you've kind of written down a sort of hard and fast rule, then there isn't the opportunity, you know, as much flexibility to adapt to changing circumstances. Things might look fine and then look very bad, and in the blink of an eye almost. And so I guess it's a case of just being tolerant of the race is trying to carry on. But also, if I would not have any, if a rider said, look, I actually want to pull out of this race and go home because I don't feel secure, then, well, that's the call for the rider and the team, and you would have to, everyone would have to kind of respect that as well. So it's a 360 degree picture, not just a sort of black and white, you know, do this and don't do that, for me anyway.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that, you know, this Giro was organised at a time when it looked like things were better, and there was obviously a lot of people predicting that there would be this second wave, but the situation looked better, and they couldn't really forecast what the specific circumstance would be when the race was organised in October. I think there's lots we could criticise the UCI for in terms of cramming so many events in, and, you know, I think that the Vuelta may prove too ambitious, not just with the COVID situation, but with the weather situation, time of year as well. Let's see, shall we? But I'm sure we'll return to these topics, and with people far better informed than us, like from tomorrow night, Ian Boswell, Lizzie Banks, and Francois Tomazo.
I've actually been looking at webcams of some of the mountains in both Italy and also the Tourmalet, where the Vuelta is due to go at the end of the first week. And, I mean, looking pretty snowy.
Well, should suit Primoz Roglic. Sorry about that. Before we go, can we say some thank yous to friends of the podcast? Thank you, everybody who signed up as a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. Your support is very much appreciated. And, of course, in return, you get exclusive episodes, and there are a couple of good ones coming up, even if I do say so myself. They're definitely ones I think you will enjoy. Thank you very much to Gregory Webb, J.A. Oldacre, Jamie Bird, James Tooley, Mark Bromley, J.L.A. Hook, Professor John Geddes, and also two people who on Twitter, well, Chris Wilkinson, thank you, Chris. He tweeted, I've listened to all 1,000 episodes, because this is our 1,003rd or 4th, and you've still not read out my name, he said. And then Rob Stephen replied that that's the same for him. So, Chris and Rob, thank you very much.
And thank you very much to Nicholas Creek, Bruce Davis, Stephen Lampier, George Harris, Ben Sherratt, Jennifer Campbell and Cameron James. If you sign up as a friend of the podcast, you get an 18 months head start on hearing the Alex Dowsett / Rosie the Dog impression. I mean, if that isn't enough to persuade you, I don't know what is. Just before we go, Rich, can I mention that our very good friend Simon Gill, Simon the photographer, is producing from some of his fantastic photographs, some jigsaw puzzles, which will be available in time for Christmas. They're available to pre-order now. And if you go to our shop, you'll be able to click on a link and go to Simon's website and pre-order. There's three great designs, 1,000 piece jigsaw puzzles. Who knows? I mean, well, great fun for all the family, aren't they? Jigsaw, get one out on the dining room table over the Christmas holidays. Well, check them out on thecyclingpodcast.com/shop.
And that's all for tonight. Thank you very much, Rosie.
Thank you, Richard.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.